Hey everyone, it's time to come together at Anthology Together, July 12th through 15th, 2021 at the Gaylord Texan Resort and Convention Center. In person, yes I said it, Elizabeth and I are excited to announce that this is the first time we will ever meet in person. The EdUp Experience will be there recording. It's going to be exciting. You can register at anthologytogether.com and enter the promo code EDUPPROMO with only the D being lowercase. That's EDUPPROMO with only the D lowercase for $75 off your registration. It's time to come together, ladies and gents. We'll see you at Anthology Together. Welcome back to America's leading higher education podcast, the EdUp Experience, where we make education your business. Hosts Dr. Joe Sallustio, Elizabeth Leiba, and producer Elvin Freites bring you the brightest and most influential minds in higher education today. We explore innovations, ideas, and issues in higher education and beyond, and hopefully have a little fun along the way. Now let's get to it.
The higher education marketplace is changing fast, and it can be challenging to stay up to date while ignoring the noise. The Evolution is the only source of opinions and insights directly from college and university leaders on the bleeding edge of transformation. We have three L's in our name, and they stand for lifelong learning, which is central to our vision for higher education's future. The Evolution is completely free to access, and new articles and interviews are published daily. To subscribe to our weekly newsletter, visit evolutionwith3ls.com/subscribe. Again, that's evolutionwith3ls.com/subscribe.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the EdUp Experience, where we make education your business, bringing you the best, brightest, and most influential minds in higher education and beyond. I'm your host, Elizabeth Leiba. And joining me today, I have my esteemed colleague, Danielle Shelton. Danielle, how are you?
Hi. I'm good. How are you?
Were you singing? What was that? I was just like, what's happening?
That's a singing intro.
I love that. I was watching The Masked Singer last night, but I fell asleep. I was just like, okay, I can't stay awake. I'll just have to watch it like on Hulu later on. But I love the singing. I'm always here for the singing. Singing is always like, it sets my day off. So I appreciate that little serenade that you gave me. And I am excited to bring our guest on because we were just talking about just some of the amazing things that he's doing. So without further ado, I want to welcome Dr. Michael Chang. He's the Dean of the Chaplain School of Hospitality and Tourism Management at Florida International University. Michael, how are you today?
I'm wonderful. Thank you so much, Danielle and Elizabeth. This is a pleasure for me. I'm very excited to join you both today on this show.
Awesome. We're so excited to have you. I am like super stoked because we just talked about you being a part of our home team right here in South Florida, right here at Florida International University. Why don't we start there? Why don't you tell us a little bit about the hospitality and tourism management program at FIU? I feel as though a lot of times we don't necessarily, or in education, we don't necessarily know a lot about hospitality management. And I think since the pandemic happened, people are becoming more and more aware of just how critical that field is, just how much it has been affected due to the pandemic, and just how much, especially in Florida, how essential it is as a part of the economy. So can you tell us a little bit about the field, how you came to be a part of that field, and what you do, and what are some of the things that you're doing there at FIU?
Absolutely.
In that capacity? Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So the field of hospitality and tourism management is very diverse. It is a global industry. In South Florida, it is especially important because Florida does rely a lot on tourism dollars. And South Florida is actually the global epicenter of hospitality and tourism industries worldwide. So us being located in South Florida is a very strategic position for us. I actually see it as one of the most, probably the most strategic locations of any hospitality management school in the country. As far as the school, the FIU Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management was one of the original six academic units that opened when FIU Florida International University opened its doors in fall of 1972. So we are actually celebrating our 50th year anniversary this year. We're very excited about
Congratulations.
That.
Congratulations, that's awesome. Woo! Yay. I like that, woo! Thank you, Danielle.
Yeah, I know. So we're definitely very excited. You know, we're one of the top programs in the country. And just recently, earlier this year, we found out that one of the ranking institutions, the QS World University ranking, they rank all hospitality and tourism management programs in the world. And FIU Chaplin School is ranked number 35 in the whole world out of 1,600 plus hospitality programs. So that's like incredible achievement for us. And the nice thing too is, I guess the best thing, best part of it is, as we look into the rankings, we also suddenly realize that we're actually ranked top 10 in the country, in all of US. You know, and the US has probably close to 300 hospitality programs, and us being top 10 speaks a lot about what we do here and our reputation. So we have, along with our reputation, we have expert faculty, a very rich curriculum, and a lot of fast track career opportunities in this global hospitality and tourism industry. We have almost 2000 students, both undergraduate and graduate, and we're the only hospitality program, literally in the whole world at this point, that has a program in China. So we have a mirror program at Tianjin University of Commerce. It's called a Marriott Tianjin China program. And it also happens to be FIU's largest international program with 1,200 students over there. So we take pride in our global reach, our reputation. We're alums. Oh, by the way, we have 17,000 alumni working all over the world. Majority of them are in the US, but we literally have graduates and alumni working in Europe, all over China, South America, all across the US.
And if someone is attending the program there, like, what are some of the like specialties, or what are some of the things that you would say, because you guys have gotten such global recognition and national recognition, what are some of the areas that you would say are like the highlights, or the areas that are really your specialty that you're well known for? What are some of the areas that students are asking for? You know, has that changed since the pandemic has happened? Like, how are you seeing in terms of your programs and your program offerings that's evolved over time?
So most hospitality programs generally have pretty much the same majors. You know, we call them majors over here, but it's either a general track of just your generic hospitality classes, and then whichever electives you choose to take. And most of our students, any hospitality students, either end up in the restaurant industry or the hotel lodging industry or the event side. So for us, our graduates coming out of FIU Chaplin School, it's pretty similar. About 30% end up in restaurants and culinary, the other 30% in hotels and lodging, and then another 30% events. The one thing that we do differently here is we really leverage our location in Miami, Florida, and our very strong industry partners. So two comes to mind for me. The first one is the world famous South Beach Wine and Food Festival, which is in its 20th year this year. Can you believe that? It's like, when I say we're 50 years old, and then I started counting the numbers, and then I suddenly realized, wow, we've been at this for quite a while. We're not green behind the years anymore, you know?
That's awesome.
So the South Beach Wine and Food Festival obviously focuses on wine and food, but it actually started as a one-day event on campus at the Biscayne Bay campus as the Florida Extravaganza. And it showcased different wines, and we had like famous celebrities including Judge Pepper and the singer Julio Iglesias that were regulars at this event. And then we did it here for 5 years before we decided that we need to grow it. And the only way to grow it was take it off campus. And that's how we ended up South Beach. So every year, there's over 100 different events over this 5-day festival. And you know, the amazing thing is that 1,200 of our students volunteer this festival every year, 1,200. You know, and they get amazing experience working with the celebrities, working in all different capacities. So this is one of the highlights of the Chaplin School that is not available any other program. Now, the pandemic obviously has put a strain on our industry, everywhere from hotel, lodgings, and events. So last year, and we were really lucky last year, when we think back, the festival ended, and then literally 2 weeks, maybe 2.5 weeks after that, the world went into lockdown. And we're like, oh my God, we were so close to having a festival that was a total disaster. But no, we were very lucky. So all last year, we were thinking about how do we recover from this? You know, nobody had an answer last year. Even earlier this year, if you asked us, like, I'm not even sure if this year we're going to have a festival, because early this year, the vaccine wasn't readily available. But now the vaccine rollouts is much more efficient and much more successful, but a lot more confident. So we are planning on having a festival this year, May 20th to the 23rd at South Beach. It'll be very different. No, I shouldn't say very, it'll be a little different. So you still have all these wine and food tasting experiences, but we'll be socially distanced. And there'll be a lot less people at each of the events. So you won't be seeing like 4,000, 5,000 people. The most you will ever see is 1,000 people. So we're definitely staying within capacity restrictions. The best thing though too, the proceeds from the festival all these years for the past 20 years have always benefited the Chaplin School. And it's provided financial aid, scholarships to our students, as well as for programmatic events that we do here at the school. This year, we're being very intentional. We want to help our industry. So when the industry went to shut down last year, we launched a relief fund with $500,000. And then we got matching donations from Badia Spices and Bacardi to start off at $1 million. And then we continue raising money and we got up to $1.6 million. And we awarded all $1.6 million out to the locally owned and operated restaurants and bars in Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach County.
Wow.
So we see that this year, you know, a lot of small business owners are still hurting. So we're actually going to allocate the funding, any proceeds that we raise, towards helping them as well. So it won't just all be towards proceeds that comes back to the school, but also back to the industry. I mean, we really believe in this industry.
That is amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So it's something that we take a lot of pride in. And the other thing I want to mention too is, because of a partnership with industry, and it was a very strong partnership, we're the only ones that actually have a spirits management curriculum within the hospitality program. So, you know, it's not like your typical ABC bartending school, but rather this is a legitimate spirits management curriculum that teaches you about the beverage laws, processing, distribution, techniques, and this is all made possible by our partnership with Bacardi. So through Bacardi, we were able to create last year, in the middle of a pandemic, the Bacardi Center of Excellence. And from that, we launched a spirits management curriculum that's the only one in the whole country, might be the whole world, as well as free online content that we call Bacardi Teach. So we saw when a lot of people got laid off a furlough last year, you know, a lot of them, this was the opportunity for them to pivot or get further education. So we say we're in the education business, we should be doing this. So we right away put out a series of modules online for people to take. And I think since then, probably over 2,500 people have completed those classes for free.
You know what, that is amazing. And one of the things that I saw when you're talking about classes and completion, one of the things that I saw is the experimental classes, the pods.
Yes.
And, the programs on demand. Can you tell me more about that? Because I know a lot of schools had to shift and had to kind of kind of pivot and say, oh my goodness, you know, students don't want to be in school for years now, or, you know, they want to go directly to their discipline and they mm-hmm. want to look for the programs within their discipline, and they only want to deal with things that are going to directly affect them and what they want to do. So what can you share with us or tell us about the programs on demand? Because I just love the name of it, first of all, but I really like the concept.
Yeah, absolutely. So POTS, as you say, the programs on demand, that was an idea that came about 3 years ago now. And it really came because this is us opening the curtains to show the whole world how higher education works. Okay, higher ed is just notoriously slow. Anytime you want to do something, you have a lot of processes and approvals you got to get in place. So the one of my biggest challenges ever since I've been working in higher education is, if you want to propose a new class to teach, you have to go through the regular process of your own department approval, and then goes up to your college approval, and then goes to university approval before it gets up to the board of governors approval. By the time you get all those approvals and before it can be taught, it's 12 months later. So whatever idea you had now is 12 months old. And I was like, how do I get around it? And that's when we cooked up this idea. We said, what we should do is just create a class, a generic title, call it Program on Demand, and but have a set prefix and set course number that we can offer it repeatable, so students can take it as many times as they want. And that will shortcut the whole curriculum approval process. So now instead of having to get approval, you're just changing out the content each time. I was like, well, that's a great way. And then the second thing we noticed too, you know, all of years of working in higher education, every one of my faculty knows that we cannot teach the same way we were taught when we were going through getting our degrees. So the old style lecture is no longer relevant today. Most of our students today prefer short bursts of information that they can apply right away. And it should be experiential too. So hospitality in itself is an experiential nature anyways. So there's no reason why we want to force anybody to sit in a classroom for 3 hours a week, or even at one stretch, it'd be like 2.5 hours. That's just too long. You know, your normal student's attention spans like 15 minutes. So after 15 minutes, you've lost them if you don't engage them. So we decided POTS could be our answer to this solution. And so if we made POTS that are repeatable with content that's engaging and experiential and that's new all the time, maybe people would be interested in it, and we were right. So that's something that we stumbled upon trying to solve the whole question of how do you provide content that's new and fresh without having to go through the process. So that's how we solved it. Since then, we've offered a lot of great POT contents, anywhere from certifications. So recently we did one for Certified Hospitality Industry Analytics. We found that during this time, a lot of people like to collect certifications, and right now they're called digital badges or certificates. So this one way for students gain that. And then the other thing too is content that's relevant to today. So there's a lot of attention today on diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives. So us offering content that's relevant to that makes it even more attractive. Students want to learn about what's happening today and not what's the old in the textbook model. This past two weekends, we actually had a Southern Glazers executive. Remember I was saying earlier how we work closely with industry? So one of my executive advisory board members works for Southern Glazers, and he decided that he didn't have enough to do on his plate, so he wanted to teach for us at the same time. So I said, sure, why not? And he developed a new pod for us, From Barrel to Back Bar, which is something completely brand new. No one has ever taught it before, or even thought about teaching it. And it's the whole logistic and supply chain process of how alcohol or spirits and wine gets from the producer all the way to the consumer. And he created a whole entire, let me back up one step. He actually wanted to offer it last spring, right before the pandemic shut us down. And it was going to be full right along with the sales drivers and then visiting different accounts, and students would have like hands-on experience. Well, with COVID guidelines, everything got, you know, canceled on that one. And then we had to pivot. So he said, how can I pivot the content and make it so that it can be delivered in a remote format? So we talked about it a lot last year. I was like, you know, you're not going to get the best experience when I teach this online on Zoom or whichever way. So we decided we should wait. So we waited, and then right as we were starting to open up this spring is when we offered it again, and he made it experiential. Now he has guest speakers that come in, and he's hosting his classes on site at the company's locations. The first week was in Wynwood, second week was in the Miramar office, and then next week will be on campus. And they're getting real hands-on. Oh, and then they're getting virtual tours. So they actually have salespeople take along like a GoPro cam, and it's a live feed into the classroom. You know, that's just amazing, right?
Last night
we just ended another amazing class too. And you might have heard about this on David Grumman, who's a hospitality entrepreneur. So he's been partners with us for a couple of years now. And that's another fascinating story that on him. A person as successful as him has two nightclubs and like, I think, five restaurants at that point, told us that he wanted to teach. And, you know, I always go, okay, if you want to offer your expertise and your experience, we'll take you up on it. So we did. First time he taught for us was in 2019. We created a 7-week class, and he brought in celebrities. The first semester that he taught for us, he had DJ Khaled and Afrojack, and then he brought the students, and this is where the experiential part comes in. He brought the students to his restaurants, Komodo, as well as Swan, and the Lyft and Nightclub, and they just loved it. Oh, and he had Pharrell too. So he's teaching about basically hospitality entrepreneurship. It's the whole team of it. But in him teaching about what he does and his business, he's allowing students not just to get a glimpse into what his life is and his business partners and what they do at Groot Hospitality. He is actually teaching them how to succeed the way that he did, you know, with his company, and which is amazing. So students really adore that. And last fall, we were going to do it again. And then it was like, you know, and he and I had a great discussion about this. And he said, if we're going to call this the David Grumman Experience, the class, you can't really have the experience if it's online or Zoom. And you know, I said, yes, I agree with you. So we postponed it, and we did it, chose to push it towards the spring. So, and we did it for the entire month of March. We changed the format entirely to make it 5 week, more content, but packed down. And then we applied social distancing, physical distancing, and COVID measures. And so the class went from 200 people to 120 people in an outdoor terrace at the Covens Conference Center. And we had guest speakers again. And the guest speakers he brought this time included David Beckham. You know, it was like everybody's jaw dropped when he came on stage. And then the first week he had Dave Portnoy, the guy from Bass 2 Sports. And I was like, wow. Yeah, Pharrell, and then, of course, Pharrell again. He also invited Anthony Joshua, the reigning worldwide heavyweight boxing champion, to come to class. So it is amazing. You know, and then we also did a class at Lyft, too. There was actually a few stories on Lyft about his class because people thought Lyft was open. Lyft's not open. It was only open for us. You know? So this is the kind of experiential program that we're talking about here at the Chaplin School.
We all know continuing education and workforce development divisions, you know, the units that offer non-degree programming, need to play a central role in supporting institutional responsiveness and growth. But more often than not, leaders only focus on the outcomes that these divisions drive and rarely think about the infrastructure they need to drive those outcomes. The team at Destiny Solutions, in collaboration with The Evolution, developed a white paper to help explain the role IT systems can play in supporting growth. To download, visit evolutionwith3ls.com/system and get the inside track on the importance of tailor-made tech. Again, that's evolutionwith3ls.com/system.
I love so much of this. This is just like, I am living for this right now, because hearing the passion that you describe your topic and your subject and everything that you're doing for your students, that's a part of it, but also just the intentionality of what you're doing as far as the classes and making them relevant, making sure that there isn't that lengthy process of a year later. It's like, okay, this is kind of outdated now. So just trying to find ways to make the learning experiential, making the topic current, bringing in people like a Pharrell, like a DJ Khaled. Like, what student is not going to be excited to learn when they have, you're meeting them where they are and creating an environment that makes it that much more interesting, exciting, and relevant. So I love everything that you're doing. I can see why you guys were awarded and why you've been recognized as far as your program is concerned. Talk to us a little bit, and you mentioned this a little bit at the very beginning of what you were just talking about the diversity piece, because that's something that I know that you've been very outspoken in terms of being more intentional with leadership of diverse populations in the hospitality management field. What are some of the things that you're seeing? What are some of the conversations that you're having on campus? And what are some of the things that the sector itself needs to do to be more responsive to some of those needs?
Sure. So diversity, equity, inclusion is a very relevant and prominent issue today in our industry. And this is, you know, this is me admitting to us having blinders on, okay? And this is real too. We, for the longest time, having been in South Florida in a community that's so diverse, and for all these years, you know, I don't have data to go back how many years, but for all these years, graduating the most Black and Hispanic students with a bachelor's degree in hospitality management in the whole entire country, not recognizing that fact, quite honestly. We just were not paying attention to that. You know, we were the second largest, we are the second largest hospitality program in the country and situated in South Florida. Graduating that many Black and Hispanic students and not acknowledging that means we're in just not really being intentional in what we're doing. And this is when last summer, within all the racial injustice and the Black Lives Matter movement, I started to take a hard look at it, and I was astounded by our statistics. I go, hold on a second, you mean to tell me that I'm reading we graduated this many Black and Hispanic students, and the next largest hospitality program that graduates the most Black students is only 36, whereas we have like 117 last year? So how is that possible, right? And the one that has 36 is University of Maryland Eastern Shore, which is a HBCU. So it really comes down to we're in the right location. And then I said, are we being intentional in what we're doing? And when I look at my faculty and staff demographics, I saw that my staff has appropriate representation demographically as well as ethnicity. But my faculty was not. And I was like, well, this can't be right. You know, and we all know that students prefer to learn from people that look like them. Students prefer to listen to people that look like them because it gives them inspiration, it gives them hope. You know, it's hard to, and we hear this a lot, honestly, it's hard for a Black student, for instance, to imagine that they can be a CEO if all the guest speakers and their professors were only white or Asians. So how are you gonna aspire to be at the executive level leadership, right? So working with NAPHOOD, which is the National Association of Black Hotel Owners, Operators, and Developers, the president, Andy Ingram, we wrote a white paper last year on the lack of executive leadership in the hospitality industry, and we were astounded. So when we look at the statistics, almost 18% of the workforce in hospitality were Black and African American, yet less than 1% of them were Black and were in executive leadership positions, which doesn't make sense. So then I look at my own statistics. I'm like, you know, I got to fix this problem from where they're coming in. First of all, we need to diversify our faculty. We need to increase our representation of underrepresented minorities, really. So we made a commitment. We worked with my executive advisory board, and there was a task force, and we decided amongst a long list of things to do is that we needed to have a class on diversity and inclusion in the curriculum created first and foremost. Second thing is someone needs to teach that class, and we need someone who represents the gap. We don't need another white person, another Asian person teaching a diversity and inclusion class in hospitality. So we made those two commitments, and ironically, or coincidentally, I should say, Southern Glazers Wine and Spirits has the same commitment towards DE&I. So they ran an internal competition called the Idea Distillery, and one of the employees came to us and say, you know what, it would be great if the chaplain school offered a class in diversity and inclusion. I go, yeah, I know. Right? And I say, we want to do that. We actually started the process already. and said, we should just join forces. So they agreed. She submitted her idea. We went forward with ours and got our course approved as an elective. And then her idea got selected by Southern Glazers to fund. And in joining forces, like that, I'm a true believer in partnership, we're able to actually secure seed funding for endowed faculty position in diversity and inclusion in hospitality management. So we're really excited about that. We have started the search process. And I think we have a slate of 5 candidates, highly qualified, that we're interviewing on Friday. So if everything goes well, we'll have our first endowed professor in diversity and inclusion in hospitality at the Chaplin School to start by July 1st. So that's our commitment. And we know D&I is not just a trendy topic. You know, it's really a collaboration. It's something that needs to be addressed. We know we have the bandwidth here and the resources as well as the pipeline. But what we also know that we need is the industry to accept the same challenges. So I don't want us to be producing graduates who think and that they could be an executive leader and walk up towards the C-suite and then have industry shut them down. So one of the ideas that we started last year too, which is coming together really fast, is the creation of an alliance. So this alliance is between universities as well as industry. And what it does is 2 things. We're going to provide the pipeline of qualified candidates of Blacks and Hispanics. And then the industry needs to create these opportunities to allow them to progress up. So it's going to be a group effort, collaborating with several HBCU in Florida, as well as actually outside of Florida. And then working with major corporations who have a commitment towards changing the landscape in diversity in the hospitality industry. So we're very excited about this new process project that we have going on. And hopefully by the end, you know, I don't know, like 3, 4, 5 years, we'll be able to see real change in the industry.
I love that everything you said. I'm going to hand it back to Danielle because I know she has tons of questions, but I love everything that you just said in that. That was a primer on getting it done. You saw there was a problem. You were like, okay, how do we fix this? Let's come up with a practical strategy. Let's bring in partners. Let's get all the resources to get it done. And then you just did it. And I it seems like it would be so common sense. And it would just be something that would happen. But like you said, in higher education, I think sometimes we have a meeting about a meeting. Danielle knows this. We have a meeting about a meeting about the meeting. And then it was like, okay, that could have been an email. You know, it's just,
yeah.
But sometimes we have the intention of doing things, but the actual strategy or the actual just like effective, just like rollout of this is what needs to happen. And then just doing it, that kind of just gets lost in the shuffle. So thank you so much for sharing that.
My pleasure.
That would be very, very helpful for schools that are wondering, like, how can they put some of these pieces together? Danielle?
Yeah, I really enjoyed everything you said. And I am really a big proponent of like the action behind the words. So it definitely made a difference that you didn't just talk about it. Because yes, I have been in more than we have been in our fair share of meetings about the meetings about the meetings. And then in the next meeting, they'll talk about the same thing they did at the meeting before, but no one, you know, will actually take the reins. And no one will be the leader. And the fact that you said, you know what, this is a problem. Representation is a problem because I am huge on people need to see, they need to be able to see with their eyes, like what they can accomplish. And I agree with you when you said, you know, you have these CEOs and you have these people who are white and they're giving these presentations. And then you have like these Black students in your class and it's kind of like, well, where's the representation? Can I attain that? So the fact that you not only saw the problem, but you decided that you were going to put things into motion that could fix the problem, I think that's great. And I am definitely an HBCU alum. So I look forward to hearing how FIU is going to collaborate with HBCUs around the nation, because it's important that our students see themselves and that they know that there's another level, that you can do more than just be behind the lines. You can be out front.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
I'd love for you to also weigh in, Dr. Chang, on, because when we talk about representation, Danielle hit the nail on the head that that's really important. Can you weigh in? Because I think a lot of us over the past couple of weeks, especially those that work in the social justice space, those of us that are in education, that are advocates for a lot of these areas with our students, were really troubled by a lot of what we saw that was happening around the country mm-hmm. over the past 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Talk to mm-hmm. us about how you're working on being intentional about speaking about the anti-Asian sentiment, some of the, myself as an immigrant, sometimes you hear about the model minority and some of the, mm-hmm. some of these stereotypes and some of these things that have been pervasive. We know a lot of these things, just as members of marginalized and minoritized communities, that a lot of these narratives are not new, but mm-hmm. we as a country are reckoning with a lot and have been over the past couple of years as things are coming more and more to light. Can you talk to us a little bit about what your thoughts are on being more intentional about mm-hmm. creating narratives that are more accurate and how you hope to continue to be an advocate for stories about real people, real Asians, and how we can counteract a lot of this mm-hmm. sentiment.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm an immigrant. I was born and raised in Malaysia of ethnic Chinese heritage. My grandmother grew up in China, and then my grandfather, they both came to Malaysia. My dad, I think, was born in Malaysia, or maybe it's China, I can't remember. Don't tell him I said that. But so I'm ethnic Chinese. I have a Chinese name. And I came here as an international student way back in 1991, a long time ago. And I've been living here ever since. And then I got married, I finished my undergraduate and graduate education, got married, and then I became a citizen, a naturalized citizen of the US. In my 23 years of living in the Midwest, I have experienced hate crimes, but I have never thought to do anything about it. I've had slurs thrown at me. I have looks given to me. And honestly, my wife is Caucasian, born in Wisconsin, grew up in Minnesota. And her family is probably one of the most accepting families. I'm probably the only non-white person in the whole entire family. I think I am actually the only non-white person, but they're very accepting of me and my diversity and my ethnicity. I just remember going up to Duluth, Minnesota all these years ago, and the first time I went to a grocery store, I could not believe the amount of looks I got. I mean, these are not just like glances. These are like stares as you're walking down the aisle. I'm like, okay, then you guys are a little weird. And I just kept on moving. So Asians in general were quiet. The whole term about model minority, I first heard that term when I was working at a community college in Nebraska. I had no idea what that meant. And it was told to me by the diversity officer at the community college at that point. He goes, when I say, what does model minority mean? So, well, Asians, you guys are quiet. You do what you're supposed to do and you don't cause any ruckus. I was like, oh, okay. And then I didn't think much more about it. And then in the last couple of weeks or months, as we see more and more anti-Asian sentiments rise across the country, I started reflecting on it more and more. And I'm like, at one point, it was probably about 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago, there was a news story about this old lady, 60, 70 something year old in San Francisco, who was a victim of violence on the street for not doing anything. Some white guy came and just hit her on the face and she fought back. And I saw the video of her holding the stick, cursing him in Cantonese, because I also speak Cantonese. I understood what she was saying. And then crying at the same time. And then waving the stick back at the guy. And the guy's on a stretcher on his back, he's handcuffed. And then I see the cop and they're all white, put the blanket around this guy on the stretcher. I'm like, huh, interesting, wow. Mm-hmm. Right? So images speak very loudly to me, and I watched the video a few times. It wasn't just once and then move on. I was like, what just happened here? And then I dug up the story and I read about it and it really hit me at that point. I said, first of all, I'm reading all these news stories about elderly men and women, Asian women, getting beat up for no reason, like getting punched in the head, getting shoved onto the street and all this stuff. And, you know, and I'm like, this is crazy. You know, in the Asian culture, we respect our elders. So you don't do this kind of stuff, okay, period. I mean, in any culture, you shouldn't be abusing your elders, okay? So that's just not right. Factor on top of that is that the Asians generally are just quiet. We don't like to draw attention. And I decided at that point that, man, I have got to put some light on this. I have got to shine the light on this. I have got to speak up because this is crazy. So that's when I did my first post on Instagram. I said, this has to stop, you know. Beating up on Asians is just not the right thing. And as I'm reflecting more and more about it, it just got me more and more agitated, I guess, internally. And I wasn't sure what to do with it, to be honest. It wasn't until I had a telephone call from one of partners from the industry who was also Asian, the guy who owns Sushi Maki. He calls me out of the blue and he says, you know, you see all these things on the news and I just want to get your thoughts on it. And what do you think? And at that point, I found my voice. I'm like, you know, this is crazy, right? We both acknowledge it. This is crazy. We need to be educating other people. We got to be talking about it. We cannot be quiet anymore. And we need to find allies. And we know we have allies. But if we don't speak up about it, no one's ever going to know you need an ally. So that's why I wrote my newsletter. I said, we need to speak up about it. And if you're not sure, if you have an Asian friend and you're not sure how they're feeling about it, ask them. It's very easy. How are you feeling about all this anti-Asian sentiment? Literally. And they will probably tell you. You know, so that was my thing there. And I wanted to educate, I wanted to engage. You know, I'm not into being an activist and, you know, holding riots and protesting and that kind of stuff. But really, we need to educate the public, even the Asian public, actually specifically the Asian public, that if you're a victim of a hate crime, you need to report it. Because the more it goes unreported, the more buried it becomes. Nobody knows about it. Okay? And if it then becomes like no news, right? And then you need to ask for help. You know, you need to reach out and you need to tell people this, how it hurts you, basically finding allies. And it's not really about race to me here. You know, even though this is really anti-Asian thing, it's really about justice for all races. Now we're all humans at the end of the day. So last week, you know, because I do this weekly newsletter, is when I said, I bet if I started to humanize this, I might actually get people to look at us differently. That's not just another Asian person, South Asian, East Asian, whichever one it is. But if I started to put faces to names and people can read up a story, it would humanize this person even more. And if they share the story of a hate crime, then maybe they will get more allies that way. And that's why I did my first post on real Asians, real stories. Real people, real stories, relations. It's really about educating, you know, and then encouraging more allyship, really what to do if you're a victim of a hate crime. You know, and I think there's a lot more work that has to be done yet. I don't know how much longer or where it's going to go in the future. But, you know, I'm hopeful. President Biden's executive order, when he took office the first or second week, and he wrote something about stopping xenophobia. I'm hoping that that will have more impact coming down. And I think with the expanded attention and honest, we could perhaps get more, action. You know, the one thing that I have noticed, I think it was maybe a couple of nights ago, there was somebody, another Asian, I don't remember if it was a man or woman, who got beat up in New York. So if somebody give me a free ticket first class to New York today or tomorrow, I'm not going to go. It's just not safe for me. But one thing I did notice in the video is they had shown the security guard saw the beating and then shut the door on it. It just ignored it. And which is crazy, right? We don't want people to do that. We want people to at least say something, yell something. Because I do believe if you draw attention to the situation, even by yelling, the attacker will stop. You know, they realize that, oh, no one's, people are not watching me. I cannot do this crazy thing anymore. So that's kind of what my feelings are. And thank you so much for letting me speak about it too.
And thank you for sharing, because I think that what you're saying makes so much sense in that we have to be vocal. When things are happening, being able to share these stories and being able to, like you said, not take it as something of, oh, I don't want to say anything or whatever the case may be, educating and putting and humanizing these occurrences and making sure that people are aware of what's happening mm-hmm. and educating the Asian community, but also making sure that people that are not within that community understand what's happening so that we can develop those allyships and make sure that everyone's on the same page so we can make change. So I really appreciate you sharing. I want to be cognizant of your time. I know that me and Danielle, we have really enjoyed everything that you said, your insights, everything that you're doing, you're making it happen. And we love that you're doing that right here in South Florida, because this is obviously, we have a vested interest in the community here. So we appreciate everything that you're doing as a strong member of the community. I want to just wrap up with the last couple of questions. The first one being, is there anything that we didn't talk about that you're doing there at the Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management? Anything that we missed that you want to just make sure that you shout out or talk about before we wrap up? And then other than that, our last parting question would be, what do you see as the future for higher education?
Those are two really good questions. The first one, I think my answer is shorter on that one. It's really about helping the people that need help. And what I mean by that is, we know the pandemic and the severity of the economy has really impacted a lot of people. What we don't really know is to what extent, right? And so in the normal pre-COVID year, we awarded $1.4 million in scholarship to all of our hospitality management students. So $1.4 million was awarded. When I was looking at our scholarship awards earlier this year. I was looking at this year-to-date report. One of the things I noticed as I'm filtering through the selections there, as I started filtering by demographics, I saw that there was a decrease in the number of awards handed out to Black students in the current academic year. And I said, well, I wonder why that is. So in one of my conference calls earlier today, I asked the Office of Scholarship to please find out the reason for that one. Now, whether it is because number one, students are not there, meaning they just didn't attend classes, re-enroll in classes, so it's not present and didn't need it. Number two, they just didn't know the aid's available. Or is it number three, they're getting funding from someplace else, which I'm not sure where. But regardless, that did concern me as to why we were awarding less money to Black students when I compared this year to last year point in time. So that's what I want our listeners to know, that no matter your financial conditions at home, if you feel that you need financial aid, all you have to do is ask. And it's not like you got to fill out a long form. You just got to let somebody know. Let an advisor know, let your professor know, let me know, let the vice dean know. It'll eventually come up to my attention. And you know, we have funding, scholarship funding that we want to help and we want to award those out. So, but we don't know until we know who you are. So, you're transparent until you let us know. So definitely let us know. The second question on the future of higher education, I think that we're moving towards it's similar to the program of demand model. It's gonna be a short burst of information. It's gonna be modularized. It's gonna be learn and apply, and it repeats over and over again. So I think we're headed towards, you know, which is another reason why we challenged the whole, why does it take a year to get a course approved, which I challenged the whole credit model. So when I was getting my bachelor's degree, it was 128 credits. Today it's 120 credits. And when you think about it, it really is a mathematical issue. Not so much mathematical, it's an accounting issue. 120 credits divided by 4 years is much easier than 128 divided by 4 years. So somebody made a decision to go from 128 to 120. So which then raised the question to me, why is it 120? Why can't we teach our students to get what they want in 1 year and then apply it, get a job, you know? And then when you need more skills, come back to us. And so it becomes a lifelong learning thing. It doesn't have to be a stop start stop you know journey. It should be a continuous journey through your life. Pick up skills, continue on, apply them, pick up new skills, apply them again. So I think that's where higher education is going. It's going to be more of an on-demand model in the future, but it requires a lot of cooperation from other units like financial aid office, the registrar's office, you know, and it requires people to really think outside the box here and question the whole concept of a degree or credit even, and the whole notion of why it's 120 credits for a bachelor's or 36 credits for a master's, or that between the range of 66 to 78 credits for a doctorate, which I have no idea why either.
Hey everybody, we hope you enjoyed that episode of the EdUp Experience. To learn more about the EdUp Experience, please visit our website at www.edupexperience.com and subscribe to our email list. Please share this podcast, head over to Apple, and please give us a rating and review. We appreciate your feedback. And of course, subscribe to the EdUp Experience so you're notified when our episodes drop. Here at the EdUp Experience, our goal is to make education your business. Thanks for listening.